Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner on our special Earth Day broadcast, and we're going to be exploring a number of things. And one of the things today to kick off this discussion of what might be the future of Appalachia, the future of America, how we can get rid of mountaintop removal and see if coal may be winding its way down and something new winding its way up. Christina Arison, one of our producers here, discovered an article in grist.org by Jonathan Hiskus called Britain's Appalachia, Engineers a Brighter Post-Coal Future. And it's also titled Saving the Whales, which I like. And Jonathan Hiskus, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, glad to be here.
So, John, tell us about this journey you made to Wales, I mean, and how you got there.
Sure. I spent a week in Wales last month visiting a number of research hubs and clean energy businesses all around the country, in Cardiff, the capital, and also on the north coast. And it was a trip sponsored by International Business Wales, which is sort of a business promotion arm of the Welsh government. So they give a biased perspective. They're wanting to show off their good work.
Talk about what Wales was historically as the kind of coal engine of Britain. Talk a bit about its history.
Sure. I compared it to the Appalachia of the United Kingdom, in that it's largely rural. It's beautiful and hilly. And for much of the past two centuries, it's been economically dependent on digging up and selling its chief fossil fuel, which is coal. So it was one of the first countries to rise in the Industrial Revolution. They had finance from England and this coal that was accessible in the southern valleys that they shipped it out of Cardiff, and that in turn drove the iron and steel industries and made it an industrial powerhouse for the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century. And it was also came to be one of the first countries to see its fossil fuel economy fall apart and one of the first to bottom out, and as a consequence, it was one of the first to reckon with what happens next. What do we do now?
And it was also, you had an interesting little side note there about the coal miner strike under Margaret Thatcher and the role it played in the kind of, see the end of the coal industry.
Yeah, there were a couple things that ended the coal industry there. One was geology, that their coal was deeper down than coal in Appalachia and other parts of the U.S. and the world, so that it was difficult for them to compete when they had to dig 1,000 feet down or more. Coal is close to the surface in other places, became cheaper. The second thing that killed coal in Wales was the miners' strike between Margaret Thatcher's conservative governments and labor unions all over Britain. It's ironic that it had this unintended environmental boon of shutting down Britain's coal industry, which was good for cutting carbon emissions, but not good for the industry that had been the backbone of the Welsh economy.
So the coal industry is dying. You said in some places in Wales, in your article, that unemployment was 25%.
Sure, higher even, I think.
Higher even. I mean, at 25% or higher, I should say.
Sure.
And that's in this country of 2.9 million people, this some people think it's a country, this is a province of Britain, is a very devastating place. So talk about how this last 10 years and what they've been trying to do.
You got it right. And the first thing to note is that the suffering and hurt has been going on for quite a while, even since the post-war era. But the 80s was when it really sort of, they really came to grips with, this is done, we need something new, we can't just be a coal mining country anymore. So over the past decade, they've invested in really a wide variety of clean energy projects. The most distinctive thing about what they're doing, I think, is its breadth. They're building solar panels. They're putting up a lot of wind turbines, both in their three coastlines and on a lot of the open ridges. They're investing in early stage marine energy, wave and tidal turbines, and they're also using their universities and research hubs really well to find ways to not just innovate and come up with new technologies, but find ways to move them into the marketplace, which is the challenge everywhere, to move things from labs into the market.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Folks, we're talking with Jonathan Hiskus. His article, Saving the Whales, Britain's Appalachia Engineers, A Brighter Post-Coal Future. We found on grist.org, or I should say Christina Arison, our producer, found on grist.org. And we're talking about this and how it feeds into Appalachia. In our next segment, we'll be talking to activists in Appalachia and hearing their thoughts about this world as well. So when you look at the article you wrote about whales, I want to get into the heart of where you think this may really be going in Wales and what it says about Appalachia. But in the midst of that, you talk about peak and crash. You have this very interesting, which we'll have on our website for people to look at, a multicolored graphic about the possible coal production where where North America is and where it is in the world. So, which is really interesting to look at, to see where it's kind of still peaking and where it's dying. And so to talk about that in the context of where we are, this battle over coal production or no coal production.
Sure. There's the question of how much coal is left, and some really smart estimates suggest there's less than people assume. But what matters even more than that is this sort of wonky term of Hubbard's peak model, which is
right.
The idea that when you first discover a resource, whether it's coal or oil, companies extract the easy stuff first. You know, why dig somewhere where you have to go down 1,000 feet when you can dig down 100 feet? You get the easy stuff first, and it's more cost-effective and profitable. But as the more accessible and easily reachable reserves are mined out, you get to the harder and harder stuff, and you get to a point where you're eventually spending more energy to extract the coal than you're gaining from it, and that's the point where it's no longer worth it, and that's what Wales has largely reached, and that's this economic model suggests every place is eventually going to reach that, and including places in Appalachia and in Wyoming's Powder River Basin.
So what did you really let's say we're in this huge transition period now, I think we are, between the possibility that America and other places in the world may be battling over how to move from coal to something different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a real argument about what the curve is to get us from one place to the next, to get us from dirty energy, fossil fuels, coal, to clean energy, if it's even possible, and how to create a new grid and all the rest. So, but talk about, in terms of that bridge, move from one to the other, what you saw in Wales and how deep the reality is there. And let's start with that. How deep do you think the reality is of what they're doing in that transition?
There certainly was a psychological reckoning of, bottoming out, and we just can't hold on. And I don't know Detroit, Michigan well, but my guess is the same thing happens there, where it's just it takes time for a whole population to come to grips with, we can't just be a fossil fuel auto industry city. You've got to find something else. So I think, mm-hmm. By 10 years ago, when Wales was given newly independent powers from the UK government, and it was able to chart its own course and determine its own economic direction a bit more, the people were ready for an ambitious plan, and that's what they asked for and what their politicians gave them. They came up with a national plan to cut carbon emissions by 40% below 1990 levels by 2020, and those goals they're hard to keep straight, and who's pledging who, but just the last year by 2020 is makes it much more meaningful.
What do they want to do by
2050 goals?
What's their goal in Wales, where they want to be by 2020?
They want to be largely off using fossil fuels to generate their own electricity and their own energy, but more than that, they want to be a hotbed of clean energy businesses and industry. So they want solar companies and wind and tidal companies to be in Wales, developing and engineering products and producing them and selling them to the rest of the world.
My remembrances of Wales, I spent some time there as a kid, was that when you say solar in Wales, that doesn't compute in my head, just because Wales doesn't seem like a very bright country.
Right.
That way, I can see where tidal, I can see wind, but solar.
Yeah, well, you're right in that most of the panels they produce, there's a sharp solar plant that sells panels that largely go to other places in Europe, sunnier places. But it's not entirely that simple because solar panels need light intensity. They don't need heat. So even places right. that aren't very warm, say the California Bay Area, can do more with solar than you might expect from
good point.
How warm it feels there.
Coming back to where your story you did in Wales, you talked about the Low Carbon Research Institute and Technium. So part of what's going on here, though, is universities coming together and businesses to figure out and work on how to incubate businesses. Maybe you could describe some of those and also talk and figure out how to kind of make this work, how you turn this theory into practice.
One resource that Wales hasn't had in addition to coal is some pretty good universities. So when they were figuring out what to do next, they realized that was a strength that they ought to be using. So this Low Carbon Research Institute is a collaboration between five schools around the country that all have parts in this. And the idea is that they do research, whether it's on holographs used in solar technology or things like that, or a lot of it's with tidal energy. Then they help businesses get started, and they help find investors, and that way the businesses aren't starting completely from scratch with the research. It's a challenge everywhere to make that lab to marketplace leap, and by having this formal arrangement, they seem to be getting somewhere with it.
Well, in observing as a journalist and who works in the environmental issues, do you think they're doing it?
I use the metaphor in my story that all these clean energy efforts look more like a field of green shoots than a mature forest or mature ecosystem. There's a lot of promising starting projects, but it's still too early to know which ones are going to survive and thrive. So it's promising, but it's too soon to know how well it's going to work.
So what did you see that was working while you were there? What did you talk about the things you talked about a wind farm? You talked about other things at the close of your article. What did you see that actually might give someone pause or hope to think that this could actually transform a place like Appalachia, how Wales is actually transforming itself?
I toured a solar plant where they took panels made by Sharp in Japan, they took cells and assembled them into the larger rooftop panels. There's a factory running at full capacity. I think it was two shifts a day, but pretty much as fast as they could go, they were building solar panels. And one thing that they recognize is that, in a small country with limited investment capital, they were going to have to attract outside companies and work with them. They did that really successfully up in the north with Sharp. I saw really intriguing models of tidal turbines. There's a picture of it with my story, but sort of a triangle frame with three underwater turbines. I think they're
right.
They're large, something like 20 meters high. They're going to drop that in the water off the coast and let it run for a year and see how it does. And if it turns out that this does generate as much electricity as they hope, they can go back and talk to investors and try to raise more capital to do more of them.
What does it say to you about Appalachia and Wyoming and places now that are battling big coal and trying to create a different world?
One is not to expect a quick fix. This kind of transformation isn't going to happen in a year or two. It's going to take some time.
Right.
But another more encouraging note is that the Welsh have this legacy of being an energy industry, and it's a matter of pride, and they're also used to it, so they're ready to and eager to accept new energy projects. They want to continue to be a leader in that. The same thing happens in Texas, where people that are used to the oil and gas infrastructure all over the place, and they're used to seeing that, they've been more receptive to wind energy than other places because they're ready to accept that. So Appalachia, I would think, has the same investment in being an energy producer and leader that they can continue.
What do you think is the political, social difference, if any, that you witnessed or reported on that allowed Wales to do what so many parts of our own country have not been able to do?
Yeah, it was striking how open the political culture was there. We happened to go to a lecture and ended up chatting to the Speaker of the Welsh Assembly, sort of there, Nancy Pelosi, which is very easy to reach and talk to. That level of partly comes from being a 10-year-old government where they just have these powers not that long, so they're still flexible and able to try new things. And it was also formed after the peak of the coal industry, so they never had to contend with the coal lobby that state and federal federal government in the U.S. have to deal with. That doesn't make our situation any easier, I guess. But it does show that, you know, an effective political climate is so key to this.
Jonathan Iskis, I appreciate you coming on our show and the work you do and the folks do at grist.org. It was great to have you on with us. Hope to have you and others from there on as much as we can.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA. 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to continue our conversation about coal, the future of our country, the future of Appalachia, how we can live a different way. And over the course of the last few years, we've talked with lots of folks who are fighting mountaintop removal. One of those is Maria Gano, who last year, of course, won the Goldman Prize. This year, she's just won a new award. She won the David Brower Lifetime Achievement Award. Now, Maria Gano, welcome. It's great to have you back on the show with us again.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
For our listeners who may be tuning in for the very first time, who may not really be aware of what's going on, let's just take a few minutes to talk a bit about your history and describing what mountaintop removal has done to your home and to your community and what this fight for your lives and for Appalachia are all about, so people can get a sense of what we're talking about, who may not even be aware.
Yeah. Well, my fight started just simply because my family's been here since the 1700s. I'm fortunate enough to live on property where five generations of my family has been raised. My grandson will make six. I'm very in love with the place that I live. I'm very in love with my family history here. I'm very connected to it. And I've fought to protect it and to protect our way of life. And the biggest threat is mountaintop removal. The culture here is very connected to our mountains. And as most mountain cultures are, they're connected to the mountains. But what the coal companies are doing is literally blasting the tops off of the mountains as much as 1,000 feet. In some incidences, they've blasted the tops off of the mountains to get at the coal seams. And what this has done is it has devastated the area that I live in. I live in Boone County, West Virginia. We're the number one coal producer in the eastern United States. And it has left the place that I love and the place that holds my family history, it's left it devastated. It's left our mountains in ruin. It's left our streams polluted, our groundwater's all polluted. And, of course, this impacts the ecosystems, the aquatic systems of these streams and the environmental systems surrounding this mountain. It affects everything. But the most important thing that it's affecting is the people and the culture. Our people are literally being run out of their communities, out of their native communities, in order for coal to expand, in order for mountaintop removal operations to expand. Our communities are being closed down. For instance, Lindy Town. You can Google Lindy Town, and it come up with a lot of information about it. Lindy Town is absolutely, it's been erased from the planet. It's gone now. And it was another victim of coal, if you will. The community there is now empty. There's one person actually left living in the community. And he is very likely to get shoved out by them blasting the mountain off just a few feet behind his house. So, we're literally depopulating the culture of Appalachia in order to supply energy to the country today.
It's almost tantamount to, I don't know what word you'd use, but something akin to the genocide of Appalachian people and culture.
Well, it's absolutely what it is. It is genocide. When you destroy a culture, it's genocide, and that's exactly what's taken place here. And I say this mainly because of the fact that what shapes our culture are these mountains. What shaped our culture is our dependence on these mountains and their clean waters. Okay, that's why we settled this area. These mountains are abundant with food and natural cures that we've always practiced. I mean, one of the things in Appalachia that we've never had good health care.
Mm-hmm.
And we depended on our Cherokee grandfathers to medicate us from these mountains. They fed us from these mountains, and literally the streams were our playgrounds growing up. And to see how it really impacts the community when they blast these mountains off and put them down into the headwaters, the community disappears. And when they destroy that mountain, the culture that depended on that mountain is destroyed too.
So, you know, I was saying as we started this interview, this conversation, that any of you, Jonathan Hiskis from grist.org, and talking about what Wales is doing to try to turn, actually the title of the article is Britain's Appalachia Engineers a Brighter Post-Coal Future, in trying to bring together all these companies and ideas to kind of create solar, wind, geothermal, all kinds of alternative energy systems, and bringing universities together and thinkers and smart people who want to create stuff with the community, trying to kind of a way to kind of turn that around so that it becomes a harbinger of the future and something different. Because you know it's going to take a while to go from coal to clean. It's not going to happen overnight.
Absolutely.
So talk about how that fits into your struggle and battle that you all are trying to do it, like with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, and what you all are doing to kind of your vision about where this needs to go.
Well, it's a constant struggle, I'm going to say that. And to try and talk anything sustainable in the state of West Virginia, you're often shut down and shut up quickly. We're up against a horrible power here in the state of West Virginia. The coal companies have power over our government even. They have power over our political leaders, over our judicial systems even. The coal industry wields amazing power here, even in our school systems. We attempted here a couple years ago to get a renewable energy computer lab, along with my daughter's help, in her local school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the principal that was helping us was relocated. She was moved to another school. So really anything we go at is met by just nothing but opposition. There's no support when it comes to creating any kind of renewable energy plan here for the state of West Virginia. But, you know, we have got to do this. I mean, it's we don't have a choice. And we recognize this simply because the United States Geological Society says there's only 25 years of mineable coal left. Now, if we don't start right away making a plan for our children's future, a clean energy future for our children, then our children are going to be left making this transition for themselves. And it's going to be a lot more difficult at the time because then coal is going to be scarce. It's going to be hard to power this country when we run out of coal. So, and coal is a finite resource. It is not renewable. It takes millions of years to make it. And so, I mean, we really have to think about it. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the colleges. I spent a lot of time talking to the youth in America. And what I see is extremely encouraging because the kids in the colleges are ready to do this. I mean, they've got a plan. They know what they're going to do. They're just waiting for all the rich white folks in D.C. to get out of the way so they can do it. And that's literally the case. That there has been kids that I've talked to at Virginia Tech specifically that was, when they initially started school, they was going into mining engineering. They seen the writing on the wall. Mining is not, it's not a stable career, especially now. And the one young man says, okay, you changed my mind. He graduated 2 years ago as a wind engineer. You know, so, I mean, literally, the youth in America sees the writing on the wall. And they won't give on this. This is their future. It belongs to them. And they will, the youth in America will absolutely see to it that we have a renewable energy grid. And it's very encouraging. So, I mean, for the folks out there that think that it won't happen, they need to rethink it simply because we don't have an alternative. We have to have renewable energy in place for our children and our grandchildren. And it's the only way that they're going to be able to survive in this world that we're handing off to them.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
Founder Maria Gonneau is one of the leading activists in the fight to save Appalachia from mountaintop removal and from the power of coal in our country. Now, I wonder politically the kind of work you have to do in West Virginia itself. You've got these, I think, the three congressmen from West Virginia. Am I right? Is it three?
Yes.
Nick Ray Hall, Shelley Moore Capito is a Republican, and another Democrat, Alan Mulholland.
Senator Byrd. Okay.
Yeah, Senator Byrd and Senator Rockefeller, right?
Yeah, right.
So Rockefeller and Nick Ray Hall and some others are and people like Rick Wise before he left Congress were seen by some of the rest of the country as fairly progressive or liberal or whatever you want to call them on a number of issues. But when it comes to coal, when it comes to mountaintop removal, when it comes to the future of West Virginia, it's a different story.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm just going to say a lot of that has to do with the fact that each and every one of them is getting their pockets lined by coal money. And Senator Rockefeller, when he initially started campaigning in the state of West Virginia, he ran on a ticket that his whole campaign was based on banning mountaintop removal,
right,
back in the 70s.
Right.
And he done a complete flip-flop. He didn't win that year, but when he came back the next campaign, he supported mountaintop removal, and he won, and he's won ever since then. But if you really listen to the way that Senator Byrd talks, you will recognize who he listens to. Senator Rockefeller, Congressman Rockefeller, doesn't listen to the people of the state of West Virginia. He listens to the powers of coal is what he listens to. And you can hear that when he talks. We went to him to talk to him back in March and showed him some aerial photos of mountaintop removal. And he went off. He literally just got irate. And he says, I'm tired of looking at those. I'm tired of seeing photos of mountaintop removal. I have to wonder, how does he think it feels for us? We live here. You know, it's not a photo for us. It's real life. You know, and if he can't look at a photo, then why should we be forced to live in it? You know, and this is because of greed and money. And that's the only reason that coal wields the power in West Virginia that it does. It all starts with greed.
I think that if people want to get a sense of what's going on, there's this great website called ilovemountains.org. And I with a small I, ilovemountains.org. And you can type in your zip code and see how you're connected to what's going on in Appalachia. I mean, I'm on the website now looking at it. It said 470 mountains destroyed. And if I just put in the zip code 212, let's take a Baltimore zip code, 17, hit that in where a lot of listeners might live, you can see just how our provider, Baltimore Gas and Electric, uses coal for mountaintop removal and gives you the story of Sylvester, West Virginia, and how that community is being destroyed so we can have the energy we have.
And, you know, I hear Sylvester, and I think of two wonderful little ladies in Sylvester that has really put Massey Energy in their place. And it's two elderly women that are their native community members of Sylvester, and they're absolutely something else to behold. They have really put Massey Energy in their place there in Sylvester. So,
is that the Canterburys?
It is. Right. Yeah, Pauline Canterbury and Mary Miller. They are two awesome elderly ladies, and I think each of us have a lot to learn from folks like that.
And we do, and so I encourage everybody, as we're talking even after we're done, and come to our website at steinershow.org and just type in ilovemountains.org, ilovemountains.org. Put in your website. You can join the 41,611 people already there who have who want to break that connection. And as people in our own middle class and inner city communities here in the area can unite with the people of Appalachia to make a different future for us all. That's one of the websites to start, and it gives you a sense of what you can do. Just one little click.
And it, you know, Mark, I think it's real important to point out that my family's been here since the 1700s. We were here long before they started mining coal. And we lived here without coal before, and we can do it again.
And it's
time for each one of us to ask ourselves, how can we make a move towards living without coal? And some of it could be solar panels on their houses. Some of it could be just conservation of energy. You know, there's many ways that we can force our government to stop killing people to supply energy to our homes. It's inhumane. This should not be happening. Electricity is free. It comes from the wind and the sun. All we need to do is harness it.
And we need to unite with our brothers and sisters and friends in West Virginia and all through Appalachia. And Maria Gonneau, it's always inspiring and a pleasure to talk to you. You always make my day.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.